Hey, it's Todd Martin along with Kat Franz, and this is another episode of Stock Talk from the Independent Professional Seed Association. We're really excited today. We have Shelly Arnoff, who is the CEO of Interplant, and also Matt Coots, who's on Shelly's board, to talk to us about what's happening with Interplant. And what really cool things are going around. Recently, we just covered that Interplant was in the news with closing a nice round of funding and had a lot of farmers involved in that process. And I thought that was a really cool deal to have farmers going on. Shelly, really and truly, let's start out. I met you a couple of years ago because Carl Peterson at the IFSA convention in Indianapolis back in 22, right after the COVID year. And, of course, was also very honored to sit on a panel for you last summer at your meeting. But tell us a little bit about how you got Interplant started and this whole concept of living sensors and how all this idea came to be in fruition.
Yeah, that's true, Todd. I was just thinking about that conference because I remember talking to Matt when I was there. Matt and I met probably a few months before that, if you remember. Yeah. So Interplant, we started the company in 2018, officially incorporated, and then we raised the first round of funding at the end of that year, beginning of 2019. We've now done, this is our fourth and hopefully last round of funding. And just for the details, Matt and his farming crew are the lead investors, and we have some other VCs that joined. The concept we came across at a university, actually. So they invented this very novel, completely not commercially viable biosensor, which I still have some pictures of it. Maybe we can share that. It was this thing that where you had to put a clips on a leaf and make the plants, connect them in the field with an internet network and all that stuff. But the initial concept made sense, which is if plants can communicate and give us the source of truth information as soon as possible, is that something that will help farmers do better and identify stresses early, act on them early, increase their yield potential, and so on. And the feedback from farmers was always very positive because I didn't come from a farming background. I just talked to farmers from early on, and they always are, I'd be like, hey, if your plants can tell you what you need, like, yeah, I'd want that. And it's genetically engineered. And they're like, of course it is. GMOs can do anything. And that was like the early days. And then once the team came together, it was clear that we have to make something that's very scalable because we're looking at soy, corn, massive acreage. And we wanted something where the technology is fully integrated, works for the farmers, not the other way around. So that's what starts to really design the solution for us. So we're looking for optical signals. We started making the plants fluoresce, which is an optical signal as a response to stress. We started with soybeans and fungal pressure because it's such a difficult thing to diagnose, and especially early within days when it takes weeks to see symptoms. And then we build a whole ecosystem around it. So we brought in John Deere and Syngenta and Growmark and Stein and just a bunch of different companies so that we can integrate our technology into their work. And that way the farmers don't have to necessarily change anything. They can just add this new piece of information and enable better results within their, my John Deere system or whatever it is.
Okay, I got to ask a few real questions on this thing so I understand the technology and it can, and in my simple mind, I can make it work. Do I understand that what happens here, this is a GMO product, but it's already USDA approved, so it can be inserted into seed.
Yeah.
And what it actually does is cause a plant, the corn, soybeans, to fluoresce under certain stresses. And you can identify the stress and what the plant needs visually. And even to do that, you're sticking satellites up so that satellite system, and you can see the stress, as it passes over just daily from that standpoint. So you can really tell a farmer, okay, you need to treat for X, this problem today. Does that drill it down to where it is?
Got it to the T. Except I would say we got lucky. We don't have to stick satellites in the air. There are satellites in orbit that could already capture the signal. We didn't know that in the beginning. So.
So you've got satellites already up, or there are satellites already up that can capture the fluorescent stress, and so you can give that to a farmer on a very regular basis, so that they can actually identify the stress early and take steps to remediate it.
Yeah, the biggest issue is really propagating seeds and that part of it, right? But from a satellite perspective, we've done now several experiments, and there's various different satellites that can see the signals just in orbit, measuring other things, really. It's just one more use case for them.
So it sounds like you're integrating the information into the systems that they're already using too, correct?
Yes. The farmers, we're
creating APIs
so we can integrate into the system. Starting with my John Deere, we're going to work into MyFS Agronomy as well, and just the different platforms that the retailers are using, which the retailers that we partner with.
So something that I think I found out that was really interesting, to at least to me. So the DNA that's inserted as part of the GMO piece, I understand, is fish DNA. Is that right? Or is based off fish DNA?
Yeah. So here's how it works. The original GFP, grain fluorescent protein, that's like the grandfather of all proteins, someone won a Nobel Prize in the 80s for this. So I don't know when it was actually discovered, probably 10 years before that. So it's been a while. That was discovered from a vertebrate in the sea. I don't think it was jellyfish, something else. By the way, something I learned from our biologist, because I'm not a biologist, is that this is usually how all biotech works. You identify something in nature that makes sense, and then you find a way to replicate it, right?
Yeah.
When they replicate it, they're not using the fish. They just need the DNA sequence. And then the DNA sequence has since been modified a lot, meaning there's actually a university in San Diego, I believe, where they developed most of the fluorescent proteins, and they're now going through many, many generations. So if you look at, there's a website called FBBase. I don't know. For us, it's been a very useful one. I don't know who else would look at it. But you can see all the different fluorescent proteins and what's their emission, what's their, you know, the different things about them that make them interesting to us, and then just what's their strength. And those have been developed a lot since that first one. So now we're going into generations with, you can think about it, it's completely synthetic because they've evolved. And they're simply sequences created by synthetic biology, much improved. That's the other important thing. So a lot brighter than the original one. If we tried to do this 50 years ago, it wouldn't work. GFP was not strong enough.
So more truthfully said then would be, it's a fluorescing gene based off of a invertebrate or a vertebrate found in the oceans.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, good enough. Think about it, like, I do understand that part because I know BTs. Yeah, I know BTs are Bacillus thuringiensis, and they came from plants, but they didn't come from corn plants.
Exactly.
So, you know, there you go. We found out something that was would take out lepidopterans, and that was positive.
By the way, think about just when you do the different pigmentations in plants, right? You literally you're enabling something that happens in a different plant. You can't create a color that doesn't exist in other, right? So it's always the colors that already exist in different varieties of crops and bioluminescence, it's fireflies. Algae, right?
Like the
things that glow, and then they replicate that in order to create that for something else. So that's usually, it's much easier apparently to find it in nature and replicate it than it is to try to create it from scratch.
I got to ask a silly question. Is the visualization of the fluorescence, is it visible to the human eye under stress, or only under, only with different instrumentation?
Yeah, you cannot see it. So fluorescence is a light that's excited by other light, meaning you can't even see it without an excitation light. And even then you need optical equipment because it's a very small amount of new light and we can't see by the eye this. I think what's also interesting, I've spent so many years explaining this technology, I make it sound very simple. In reality, to figure out what the signal is very hard. So you need a lot of machine learning and AI. That's the parts we're doing now in order to just decipher what the signal is from the noise and then build that into the other models that we create to understand what we're looking at. And then that feeds into those models that the farmers are going to get through their agronomy systems. All of that is part of the product. So it's not like you see a signal and, you know, sometimes we show the demo, which is glasses and a laser, and you can do that. But that's not how the actual system works. That's a lot more software oriented and machine learning than just the demo that we show people in the field.
So one of the things that I guess, and here's how I relate some of the things to it as well. I mean, I've spent over 35 years in the ag industry. I hate to admit that, but I mean, no hair and what's left is gray, so or white. But 35 years and started out in the crop protection side and was with a company. We sold a lot of fungicide products, was one of the fungicide leaders.
Which one was it?
Yeah, globally. So what we did with several products, we found that if you put products out early, anticipating, you know, different disease and fungal diseases and stress that was going to happen on the plants, then, you know, obviously, you got a better response than if you did it late when there was already, when it already showed up. Problem right. with that is that also was a bit of a misnomer. You would put it out and you may not have needed the problem. And so farmers spent money in that situation.
Yeah.
Is the system from Interplant one of those that can really identify the stress so that you can eliminate, I would call what we did kind of an insurance buy. We're going to spray this out because we're trying to ensure that we, if we have a problem, we're taken care of. This is a situation where you don't need to make the insurance buy. It's a situation where you can see the problem and treat the problem before it becomes a severe problem. Is that, would that be a correct statement to you?
Yeah, absolutely. The signals come up, our signals come up within 2-3 days of the initial infection. It takes anywhere from 10 days to 3, 4, 5 weeks to see symptoms, depending on the disease and the severity and so on. Realistically, today in the U.S., a farmer for soybeans is either going to go out at R3 or they're not. So the big question for us is, if there is stress showing up earlier, you should go earlier. And at that point, it's kind of a decision by the farmer with the support of the agronomist. But really, you know, if you've got a 3-week buffer, you're going to do your calculation. You should go out to the field early. And then the nice thing is, like you said, I think catching a disease early, it's almost like catching a weed early. It's the same idea. Do you want to kill a seedling or do you want to kill a full-on plant? And it's the same. By the time you're seeing symptoms, you've got a full-on infection going on everywhere. And it's raging. And getting rid of that is incredibly hard. That's why you can't really cure it at that point. A risk insurance mitigation, you know, you might not get a signal until R3 and you might still want to go out and do that, right? Because maybe too late later, that's still an option. But we want to provide the farmers and the agronomists as much information, then make that decision. When's the right time? Do you want to go again? Do you not want to go at all? And what's, you know, that depends on commodity pricing. So it depends on a lot of things sure. that we can end up doing every year.
Well, it strikes me immediately that from a return on investment, a return standpoint and yield standpoint from a farmer, it'd be a valuable tool. But I'm guessing here, Matt, you are a farmer. Even though you're yes. Canadian and, you know, we don't really like Canadians down here. Matter of fact, yes. you know, our current president for IFSA, Colin Steen, is a former Canadian. Yeah.
No, he's still a Canadian. You can't get rid of it. So.
No, if you know, when you pledge to America, you're out of everywhere else. You
can I think that they think about Canada like Texans think about Texas. Like, even if you move out of Texas, you're still Texan.
Yeah, well.
Catherine,
is that your deal? You haven't been in Texas in what? Yeah. 20 years and now you're like, I'm still a Texan.
It's not been 20 years. You were aging me.
10 years, 15 years, 7, 3 years, whatever. Matt, what do you think about all this? I mean, you're on the board, clearly you're heavily involved. What's your thoughts about all of this?
So I think, you know, the discussion you and Shelley have had is it makes it pretty obvious why we'd be excited about it. We can see issues weeks earlier, to get ahead and apply early, or to your point, you're not seeing anything and you're reducing your cost. So whether you use return on investment, we would kind of use gross margin, and gross margin percentage is kind of a primary variable here. And we've seen it as a massive differentiator on how we can continue to optimize our crop in season. You know, we do a lot of in-season planning on seed and things like that. And traditionally the seed work kind of ends early June for us, but with Interplant, we've seen it kind of getting benefit from the full season. Of course, we don't grow soybeans in Saskatchewan, so we're just watching from afar, and that's why we wanted to invest. Is, you know, we see a huge opportunity. So you take kind of the obvious product dynamics, you couple it with Shelley's skill set and her team, and then their overall commitment to farmers. You know, we meet a lot of startup companies, some headquartered in California, some headquartered in the Midwest, et cetera. but they rarely fly up and have a meeting out in Kindersley, Saskatchewan, which I'm sure everyone's gonna have to Google, and make a pitch to farmers on why they should use the product or invest. And Shelley did that, no problem, and with enthusiasm, and be able to actually persuade, you know, 12 to 15. Well, there was maybe half a dozen of us that invested in the room, and then we just had kind of other guys from the farm there. So to see the commitment to farmers plus the obvious technology benefits really got us excited as investors.
So that's really cool. I've had the opportunity to be involved in some venture cap companies and, yeah, you know, familiar with the fundraise part. But when I saw the article about, hey, a group of farmers have invested to throw in money into this round, I mean, look, that's not a headline you normally see. And ag tech has been under a lot of financial pressure the last couple of years with interest rates going up. And, you know, people have been pulling back a little bit more and more. So to me, that was a very compelling story, is that farmers are saying, hey, we like this technology. We think this is smart in the future, and we're going to put our money where our mouth is here because we think this needs to move ahead. Can you add a little bit more to that for me, Matt, and what y'all thought process for? And then Shelley, I also want your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So, you know, it's simple, right? Like that, you know, I'm sure your audience is quite aware of the economics of the seed business and the trait business. And, there was some definitely attractiveness compared to the volatility we deal with as farmers. You know, it's smoky here in Saskatchewan today, and, you know, and it'll be too sunny tomorrow and too cold the next day. So, kind of from a business perspective, you know, there's the, some, you know, consistent recurring like, revenue that we like with the seed business, and the ability to scale it, where, you know, most of the companies we come across as investors, have, you know, their niche is quite small, right? They dominate locally or regionally, or a specific crop or something like that, but rarely do they have the ability to be on acres across the country at scale. So that was super attractive. But like any of these things, companies are just a product of its people. And, you know, Shell is obviously impressive, but there's a lot of people around her and her team kind of throughout the whole company that all are a tick above average for sure. So,
okay. Shelley, I mean, really, it's a compelling headline. How else did you pull that off, or what did you do to, you know, get all
free
the
merch?
Yeah, there we go. Free merch. Must have been good merch.
Yeah, I got a lot of feedback about not enough merch. We're working on it. So just to give you some of the background story, Matt's been in our inner circle from 2021, and an angel investor in the earlier days. And in 2022, I invited him to the board. So he was an independent board member before he decided to lead the Series D. And now he's, you know, the Series D lead. But I'm trying to remember why I invited Matt to the board. We get along. We talk a lot. He's really smart. Mm-hmm. Knows farming remarkably well, but not just because, you know, you grew up and are operating a big farm, but he reads about everything. And he's really also an investment banker.
Not a banker. No.
What did you study? Financing?
Yeah.
He's, you know, a finance dude. So he knows financial statements. He understands kind of the P&L. He understands the business aspect of it as well, not just the farming aspect, which is very compelling. So like, I started to call him up a lot, get his advice. And then when the round was coming together, we're doing the usual Silicon Valley startup VCs, and I know them. I'm based in the Bay Area. I went to business school at Stanford, so that's really the world I came from. But it wasn't my preference, mostly because I don't think investors understand agriculture. There's not really any truly successful ag investor that are able to lead Series B, Series C rounds, right? Because at that point, you're talking really large funds. And from the generalist, they just have no idea what farming is about. None of them have ever been on a farm, right? If we want to be clear, what are the chances of finding someone that's been on a soybean farm and has been somewhere in Iowa to see what it looks like? So the gap is really broad. And for me, it was really important that our board and our investors represent the company that we want to be. And that's not a Silicon Valley company, it's a farming company. So as Matt brought up the idea of getting involved more and more in the Series B, it was clear to me that this is the path we want to take. And what's funny is that eventually we had a few other climate investors join. I think they're all good people, but it makes a lot more sense for me for them to follow Matt and the group that knows farming and that represents the customers and that knows our customer and our partner space, and just have the investors kind of alongside that than the other way around.
Got it. And Matt, I do have to tell you, you know, I think most everybody knows where Saskatchewan is. And, you know, you act like we don't have Letterkenny down here in the United States. One of my favorite shows. And Colin Steen has definitively said, that's like my real hometown. I mean, that's like the way it is. You got the skids, yep, and, you know, straight through. So there you go. We understand.
It's cheaper production if it's like reality TV, right? So.
Well, look, so some really exciting stuff going on here. What I guess the next piece is you know, projecting a little bit into the future. Obviously, we're talking about biological systems. So, Shelley, you mentioned early that, you know, one of the things is you got to get seed and get seed multiplied and set out so you can actually have material to be able to plant. When are you looking in timeline on being able to have a full launch? I do understand soybeans are the first crop. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So what's your timeline that you're thinking right now with regards to getting soybeans to the market? And then what's after that? Obviously I know corn will be a big target. You know, I'm going to assume, Matt, canola is probably going to be a big target up in y'all's direction too.
Definitely influencing.
So what's the timeline on in what crops do you think?
So one, we are commercially launching for 2025. We call our first product Crop Voice, which is an insight platform fueled by our inner soy sensors. And what we're doing is we're launching in Illinois. We're working with retailers to be able to then provide this to their growers. And mm-hmm. This works through a network of our Sentinel plots. So these plots range anywhere from a quarter acre to half an acre, and they're going to be located in different areas so we can create coverage. And this is the way we view it is step one. We can give you information around the threat in a reasonable area. And then there's going to be two more steps. The next one is getting it on farmers' fields. So as we do the next generation and we have the ability to scale more and more on the seed side, we're going to provide this as an offering to the farmers, where if you have, I don't know, 15,000 acres, you can have your own plot. Maybe you have a couple of them, right? And then the last solution is the full seed solution, which does require an HT package. And we have partnerships on that. We also have our own offering. The reality with biotech is you do a lot of different things, a lot of different approaches. And then I can't imagine that being ready before 27. I want to say 26, and maybe we'll have some scale, but then to get into a more reasonable scale, 27. That's really the goal with soy. Mm-hmm. We are working on corn. We started working on corn about, I want to say, a year and a half ago. So it's still in early stages, but it's following along. And then we'll likely start working on canola. We'll definitely do it. And I think we're starting to do it now. Again, biotech takes time. So there's a whole process that goes into it.
The canola is a little, it makes me feel good to hear about it, but it's obviously a difficult market to get into. So acres wise and concentration of suppliers, right? So but I think Phil and I go back and forth on corn and with the corn nitrogen signal and less so on the disease, and we go back and forth on is it going to increase nitrogen use or decrease nitrogen use. And I think, you know, that's going to be exciting to see, because I think as farmers, we, you know, we're always trying to grow the most grain, right? And can we be doing a lot more in-season applications, something we don't do much in Canada here with the short season, but it certainly gets exciting to think of all the different implications on how you can manage your farm if you're doing, but again, a bunch of liquid nitrogen applications throughout the year and less upfront. Like, for example, we put down 220 pounds of urea with our air seeder, and then not really nothing throughout the rest of the year. So quite a bit different than, you know, your corn type product. So that excites us on how, you know, on the big nitrogen crops and on how things can change.
Well, you know, one of the things, and of course, from a sustainability standpoint, let's face it, nitrogen use and reducing nitrogen, more effective use of nitrogen, is high on everyone's list at this point for a lot of different reasons. So, I mean, clearly, if there's a more effective way to put nitrogen out to get yield or, you know, actually see a reduction there, that's a very big benefit from that standpoint, you know, in this new sustainable world that, you know, we're moving into, it seems. Matt, what do you think about, you know, some of these sustainability factors there from your perspective as a farmer? I mean, there's a lot of talk about carbon, a lot of talk about nitrogen reduction,
Matt,
a lot of talk about cover crops.
Carbon.
It, I guess it's technically on my list, but it would be right near the bottom. So, so
more,
you know, the
yield,
most
more yield.
The most sustainable thing is making money. I think it's weird for a Canadian to tell Americans that. But that's our focus, is how we can have a more sustainable net income line and cash flow line. And I think the environmental benefits follow that quite tightly. Whether it be, you know, we think if we want to run a good business for the long term, we have to make good long term agronomic decisions. And they almost always coincide with good environmental decisions. There's like rarely where we're putting up like some mercury mine to enhance yields or something like that. That's just not likely to happen. So, so we act rationally from an environmental perspective, but it's not the intention. It's usually a result of other priorities.
Which I think goes right along with where I am on this. I think that sustainability and renewable agriculture and, you know, regenerative ag, as it's being called a lot, is a great thing. But you know, you're here to make money. How's the return? Statistically, can we find ways to reduce inputs and maintain or increase yield through more effective use? Hey, I think that's great science. And I mean, we see that kind of reduction of inputs. I mean, that's what I get when I start thinking about the effectiveness of Interplant. And for one of your partners, Shelley, or your investors with John Deere, had an opportunity to see their massive $850,000 See and Spray carbon fiber 100-foot boom. It is super impressive. I wonder how much they're going to have to pay somebody to drive that thing, or if it's just going to drive itself. But, you know, the ultimate piece of that is through See and Spray technology, a reduction in overall inputs year to year. Of course, $850,000 is a lot of money for a sprayer, but it is super cool. That's for sure.
Yeah. Like, on that topic, from a sustainability perspective, like we use all X9 combines, all, you know, John Deere, and trying to do See and Spray where we can, biologicals on all our lentils. And that's all with the intention to make us more profitable. But to your point, you know, those are wasteful resources for the environment as well. Excess fuel. You know, if we can have the soil do more work for us and the nitrogen do less work, that's what it's all about. And yeah, if the equipment's nice, and if there's a way that, you know, that number could go down, that would be nice as well.
Yeah, that'd
be
nice too.
I think Deere had their earnings out today or last night. So, but they're certainly high return products, for everyone involved, mm-hmm. I think. So, particularly with the X9 and the efficiencies we found there with fuel usage, and what we intend to find over time with See and Spray, like as you mentioned with canola, and our main crops, our three crops are lentils, canola, and wheat, and so, you know, they take a bit longer to get mainstream kind of on the computer vision and all those things automated, but we're incrementally getting there for sure. So.
So Shelley, as we're coming to our time and closing a little bit, the important question for everybody at Ipsa, you know, how do you envision collaborating with independent seed companies going forward on your technology? I mean, like I said, we were introduced by Carl Peterson with Peterson Farm Seed, and Carl certainly likes to get engaged with some cutting edge technology. How do you see working with independents?
I mean, I started talking to Carl very early on, right? And then, I got lucky. So I don't know if people know this, but Nick Koshnick is the founder of Solem Tech. He's like second nephew or something. So this is how I got connected to Carl, and it was 2019. And from that's how we got connected to the Stein Group. to me, it was always clear that this is how we take the product to market. The incumbents, the large seed companies, don't necessarily need more innovation coming. Now, I'm not saying they're not going to get on board. I'm just saying, are they really going to be the first one to push a new product to market that they didn't make and they're not, you know, developing over 10 years? I think that's less likely for a startup to believe. What's more likely is that we can work with the independents and bring this to farmers. And at the end of the day, when the farmers decide that this is something that they want, then of course everyone's going to come on board and they have the ability to really bring offerings to market and bring it in any brand name in every bag of seed that farmers want. So, I mean, that's the reason that it's been our focus from the beginning and still is. Right. And I was very inspired. I enjoyed all the IPSA interactions. It's been nice to see the independent seed companies, to see that this still exists, to be honest, because it wasn't clear to me in the early days how many independents are still out there when all you hear is Bayer and Corteva, right?
Well, we are finding that our numbers are still out there. As a matter of fact, we're going through a little bit of membership expansion right now. So we're hoping to push into that 150 to 200 member number on seed companies, which will be a big advantage for us as where we're going through and talking with folks. And, you know, still looking at a pretty strong market share outside of the traditional Bayer and Corteva market share into the independents. But you're right. I mean, one of the things is that large companies tend to promote their own innovation. And when innovation comes from elsewhere, independents are the ones that can grab hold of that. And, you know, I always like to say and think that when hybrid corn came about, there were not a lot of big companies grabbing hold of that. There were a lot of small independent companies that got started up that have their roots in 70, 80 years worth of family history. And even at least one big company that came out of it, which was Pioneer. So, you know, we have a history of innovation in the independent seed space. There's no doubt about that.
Actually, Todd, I'm curious. It seems to me when I started Innoplant, really started looking at the industry, it felt like that was the peak of consolidation, 2018, 2019.
Yeah, that was pretty much the peak of consolidation.
But it feels to me like there's more and more of going into the other direction. It feels now that there's more and more independent seed companies and just also the ones that are out there are getting a little bit bigger. They're getting a little bit more visible. Just, I don't know, maybe, you know, you have the data. To me, it's just a feeling.
Yeah, no, we've actually seen a lot of that. And I mean, it's always something that we're concerned about sitting, you know, in the IPSA seat. Catherine and I talk about this a lot. We talk about it with the board, our concern about concentration of large competition and how it affects the independent seed companies. But, you know, as we've gone through, we've seen more independent seed companies coming into the licensing space, which has been a little bit of a shock. A couple of new companies starting up over the last few years and, you know, some companies that still want to be involved. Clearly, with $354 corn, there's a lot of financial pressure. Margins are tight. And there are some folks that are at that retirement stage that are consolidating into other independent seed companies. But by and large, you know, there's some reason to be hopeful as we start to progress forward that the independents continue to strike out a good market share. And even historically, we've seen over the last 15 years, as some of the majors acquired independent seed companies hoping to buy share, that share kind of floated back out to other independents that were independent and away from those companies that acquired the brand. So it's all really interesting to see how it is going. And I, like you, think the euphoria of having these super mega sized companies out there really has not proven particularly positive in the marketplace. I mean, let's face it. We do understand that Bayer has got some, you know, financial struggles, and we see that in dramatic news footage. And, you know, we do see independents continuing to gain some ground. So that's always possible. Well, look, Shelley, Matt, thank you very much for joining us today on Stock Talk. And we really do appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for y'all coming on. Appreciate it. And very interesting to learn more about Innerplant, and hope to see y'all at the annual conference in January. Thanks for listening today. Please like, share, and subscribe to bring more folks into our Stock Talk community.